The hoofbeats weren't long in coming. They stopped before they reached the top of the trail. Somebody in Tarleton's bunch was smart enough to realize that it would be a mistake to ride out into the open without knowing what was waiting for them.
Browning! Are you up there, Browning?
Come on up, Trace!
And ride into a bullet? I don't reckon I'll do that. Why don't you send Miss Tarleton down here? And then we'll talk about what happens next.
I don't reckon I'll do that. If I turn her over to you, I won't be long in dying. Or maybe I will, if that fella Loomis has his way.
Well, you're probably right about that. But where are you gonna go? There's no way out for you up there.
How do you know that?
Trace didn't answer. The silence told the kid that he had scored a point. Trace, Tarleton, and the others didn't know what was up there. There could be another trail leading out. They had to be careful.
Give us Miss Tarleton, or we'll kill one of the prisoners.
If you hurt any of them, I'll kill her.
We got three chips. You got just one. You sure you want to throw everything into the pot first thing, Browning?
The kid grimaced. Trace was right, dammit. He was at a disadvantage, so he couldn't afford to wait.
We'll make a trade. Miss Tarleton for all three hostages.
That ain't hardly fair. Three for one? How about we just trade gals?
All or nothing. That's the way it has to be.
Trace didn't say anything. The kid figured he was talking it over with Tarleton. He took advantage of the opportunity to study his surroundings a little better. There was no trail up the cliff at the back of this bench, but he noticed a ledge farther up the side of the mountain that led off to the north and then angled down. That might be a path out of the hatchets, the kid realized, if there was any way to get to it. He peered up at the face of the cliff and saw a place where a fang-like rock jutted out. If he could throw a loop over that rock, he could climb up to it, use it for a foothold, and reach up to grasp the ledge, which was only about 4 feet higher. He was confident he could make that climb up the rope, but could James and Maggie and Whitfield? They might be able to if they had some time. It would be dangerous, but worth the risk, especially if the alternative was certain death at the hands of lunatics and hired killers. Someone would have to cover their escape, though, he realized. That would be his job.
How do you want to work this swap?
You mean you agree to it?
Mr. Tarleton wants his niece back, safe and sound. He's willing to let all you go in return.
The kid didn't believe that for a second. Tarleton was up to some sort of trick, but the kid didn't see any option except to play along for the moment.
I'll send Miss Tarleton down the ledge to the lower bench. You send all three prisoners up. I'll have my rifle on Miss Tarleton until the McTavishes and Whitfield are up here with me.
Again, there was no response for several moments.
All right, but you damn well better not be trying any tricks, Browning. Our guns will be pointed at the three of them, too.
All right. Give me a minute.
The kid eased back from the edge, not standing up until he was out of the line of fire of the gunman hidden in the brush. He went over to Pamela, reached down to grasp her arm and helped her to her feet.
I know you heard all that. You're going back to your uncle.
What in hell?
Her eyes glinted in triumph. She thought she had won. She didn't realize that all he was trying to do right now was secure the freedom of the McTavishes and Whitfield. Once the three of them were safe, he'd be going after her and Tarleton and the rest of them. Actually, he figured it was likely they would rush him, and he would make a final stand on this lonely, windswept bench high in the Hatchet Mountains. That was all right. He would trade his life to avenge Rebel if that was what it took. But if he did that, Pamela would probably escape justice, he realized. He couldn't afford to die yet. He couldn't stand by and allow the prisoners to be tortured and murdered, and he had no doubt that was what would happen if he didn't go through with the swap. Circumstances had maneuvered him into a bad spot. Or call it fate, destiny, what have you. When he came right down to it, he had to try to save the hostages. That was what Rebel would want him to do.
Come on.
The kid steered Pamela toward the ledge.
I'm not going to untie you or take that gag out. Your uncle and your friends can do that for you once you're back with them.
He stopped short of the ledge and let go of Pamela's arm.
Go ahead. but take it slow and easy.
She cast one last hate-filled glance over her shoulder at him, and then stepped out onto the ledge. She started down, moving slowly as he had told her. The kid stretched out again in a cluster of several small rocks that gave him some added cover and thrust the Winchester's barrel over the edge. He couldn't see Pamela as she descended the ledge, but he'd be able to track her with the rifle as soon as she stepped out onto the lower bench.
Miss Tarleton's on her way down! Send the hostages up!
Hang on!
Damn it, you better not be backing out on the deal now!
Take it easy! Here they come!
A moment later, James and Maggie McTavish appeared on the trail that led through the heavy brush. James had his arm around his sister's shoulders. Behind them, Dave Whitfield trudged along the path. The rancher looked gray and exhausted. None of them was tied up. They moved on to the lower bench. Their steps were stiff. The kid figured they had to know that several rifles were trained on them at that moment. They walked across the bench toward the spot where the ledge began. Pamela reached the bottom of the ledge and moved out so that the kid could see her again, and she walked toward the three hostages, moving a little faster than they were. It took only a minute for her to reach them.
Hold it! Pamela, you stay there!
For the first time since this standoff began, Anthony Tarleton spoke up.
Like you said, it's too late to change the rules, Browning. Let Pamela go, or I'll have my men kill those prisoners right now!
I'll put a bullet in her head at the first shot! I'm not backing out of the deal, I just want the others up here first!
All right. Just wait right there, Pamela. You'll be back with us shortly.
The prisoners moved on past Pamela. As they approached the ledge, the kid couldn't see them anymore. He kept the Winchester's barrel rock steady as he aimed it at Pamela. Would he pull the trigger if Tarleton tried a double cross? Could he? Killing some of those gunmen without giving them a chance didn't bother him. They were cold-blooded murderers with plenty of blood on their hands. They had chosen to live by the gun. They knew that the odds were that they would die by it as well. Pamela was different. She had probably never carried out an act of real, personal, face-to-face violence in her life. But she had plotted rebels' kidnapping and murder, as well as everything else that had happened to torment the kid in the past few months. She had ordered someone's death more than once. Was that the same as committing murder herself? Was it actually worse? The kid didn't know the answers to those questions. He didn't know if he would pull the trigger either. He reckoned he wouldn't know until the time came, if it ever did. He heard the scuff of footsteps on the ledge. The prisoners were moving faster now as they approached freedom. Suddenly, James McTavish reached the top of the ledge and came hurrying onto the upper bench, practically dragging Maggie with him. Dave Whitfield came along behind them.
Get back there by the cave. They can't get a shot at you once you're there.
All right, Pamela, go on down.
She glanced back at him, but she was far enough away that he couldn't really make out the expression on her face, especially with the bandana tied across the lower half of it to keep the gag in. He would have bet a hat, though, that she was seething with anger and hatred. She strode toward the brush, moving faster. After a moment, she reached the trail and stepped down onto it. He watched as she disappeared from his view. A pang of loss went through him. He was back to where he'd started, trying to avenge Rebel's death. He had had the person responsible for that atrocity in his hands, and he had chosen to let her go. It hadn't really been much of a choice. Whitfield and the McTavishes didn't deserve to die because they had gotten caught in Pamela's vicious plot against him. The kid kept his rifle trained on the opening in the brush. He could see people moving around down there. He expected Tarleton's men to start taking pot shots at him, but so far nothing had happened.
James, get the rope off my horse and see if you can throw a loop over that rock that's sticking out up there.
James didn't do as he was told.
What are you dressed up for, Browning? You look like some sort of dime novel gunslinger.
Just do what I told you.
Are you thinking we can climb up to that ledge? Hell, there's a better way to get out here than that.
The kid looked around.
What are you talking about?
Whitfield used a blunt thumb to point toward the dark hole in the cliff face.
That's Dead Engine Cave. In the back of it, there's a little crack, a chimney, I guess you call it, that runs all the way back to the top of this mountain. It ain't the easiest climb in the world, but it's easier than trying to shimmy up a rope on a cliff while somebody's shooting at you.
How do you know about that chimney?
I told you, I've hunted these mountains and dodged Apaches, too. They chased me into that very cave about 15 years ago. I figured I was a goner, but then I found that crack and climbed out through it. Apaches don't know what's there. They won't come anywhere near that cave because of them old bones in it. Bad medicine, they call it.
All right, Whitfield, lead the way. Get those two youngsters out of here. I'll stay behind to cover you.
No, you have to come too, Mr. Browning.
Somebody's got to stay. Otherwise, those killers will just rush up here and shoot us while we're trying to climb out.
Your brother's right, Meggie. Go with him. Show them the chimney, Whitfield.
Come on, you two.
Whitfield led them toward the cave. As the three of them disappeared into the cave, the kid settled down to wait for the inevitable battle. The taut silence had already hung over the mountainside for longer than he expected. Suddenly, the enemy was shooting at him from above. The kid rolled over onto his back as a slug whipped past his ear and slammed into the ground beside him. Some of the dirt got in his eyes and blurred his sight. He didn't have to see perfectly to know the shots were coming from the ledge he had considered using as an escape route. The kid brought up his rifle and aimed at the cliff. He got to his feet and ran toward the cave. Slugs kicked up dust at his feet, but he was moving too fast for the rifleman to draw a good bead on him. He knew what had happened. One of his enemies down below had spotted that ledge and realized that anyone who managed to climb onto it would have a good shot down at him. Tarleton had split his forces, sending some of the hired killers to work their way around and get onto the ledge. If the kid had sent Whitfield and the McTavishes up the rope, as he'd intended, they would have been climbing right into the gun sights of Tarleton's men. The kid reached the cliff and pressed his back against the rock face. The shots fired by the men on the ledge couldn't reach him there, but he couldn't hit them either. Even worse, he couldn't keep the rest of Tarleton's men from getting to the lower bench and coming up that ledge. A grimace twisted the kid's face. They had backed him into a corner, all right. All he could do now was to go down fighting.
Browning.
The kid glanced over and saw Dave Whitfield emerge from the dark hole in the cliff.
What are you doing here? You're supposed to be helping James and Maggie escape.
I got him started up that chimney. It's about a 300-yard climb, and it's steep and tight. It'll take him a while. There ain't nothing else I can do to help him now. But I can still play a hand down here.
No, get on up there while you still can. I'll hold off Tarleton and his men from inside the cave. They'll be here any time now.
Damn right they will. But you ain't gonna hold them off.
Whitfield reached out and closed his hand around the kid's Winchester.
I am.
This is my fight.
Yeah, it is. But I sat in on the game, and now I'm cashing out, Browning. My ticker's shot.
Your heart?
That's right. Something's busted inside. I felt it when it happened. So I know I ain't going home. If those two kids got a chance of getting out of this alive, it's you.
The kid's mind reeled. He knew Whitfield was telling the truth. It was obvious by looking at him that something was very wrong.
Damn it!
There ain't time to go on about anything. Come on, I'll show you the way out of here.
The kid finally let go of the Winchester. Whitfield nodded toward the cave, and they both hurried into its dark maw. They had to step around the ancient skeleton to reach the back of the cave. The sun was high enough now so that its rays slanted into the gloom. Whitfield gestured toward the low-hanging ceiling.
Up here.
The kid moved closer and saw the narrow slit in the rock that he hadn't noticed before. It started from the rear wall, ascended at a steep angle, and was so dark he couldn't see more than a couple of feet up it.
You sure it still goes all the way through?
Well, if it don't, then you and them other two are in a pretty bad fix. But if you stay here, you know you'll end up dead.
The kid nodded. Whitfield was right. The opening was so narrow that the kid wasn't sure if his shoulders would fit through it, but the brawny James McTavish had made it, so he supposed he could too. He turned to Whitfield and held out his hand.
They call you Devil Dave, but I reckon...
Oh, hell, I told you not to start going on.
Whitfield gripped the kid's hand.
Chances are I'm just as bad as McTavish has made me out to be. Damn, I hope old Hamish pulls through anyway. And one more thing. If you get out of this mess alive, Browning, I'd sure be beholden to you if you'd tell my daughter that I love her. Help her out in any way you can, will you?
Sure, Dave. You have my word on it.
I reckon that'll do then. Now, get the hell out of here while you still got a chance. I think I hear him coming out there.
The kid reached into the chimney and pulled himself up until he could get a foothold and push himself higher. The stone walls closed in around him, scraping his shoulders and threatening to take his breath away. His heart pounded heavily in his chest. He crawled upward into the pitch blackness inside the mountain.
Come on, you mangy poker.
From his voice, there was no way to tell that Whitfield was already dying. The kid had seen it in the rancher's eyes. Whitfield was sacrificing what little was left of his life to give him and the McTavishes a chance to escape. The kid kept climbing. He had to press his feet against the sides of the shaft to keep from sliding back down and pull himself higher with his arms and shoulders. It was grinding, exhausting work. The darkness surrounded him like a black shroud, and from time to time he had trouble catching his breath. If he could see just a flicker of light above him, he thought, so that he would know he was climbing toward freedom, that might make the ordeal easier. Only moments after that thought went through his head, he saw a faint glimmer in front of his eyes. He thought at first he was imagining it, but then he realized it was really there. From somewhere high above him, a tiny ray of light had penetrated into the mountain. It shone on a bit of metallic rock wedged into the side of the chimney. A flick of gold, or silver maybe. A grim smile tugged at the kid's mouth. He might be climbing right through a bonanza and not even know it. Although it was more likely the rock was mere quartz or something like that. The kid couldn't hear if Whitfield was shouting anymore, but he knew the rancher was still alive. If he wasn't, the shooting would be over. The kid tilted his head back and peered upward. He could see an actual opening now, with a bit of blue sky in it, but it was no bigger than his thumbnail. The sight encouraged him. The fact that he could see it told him that James and Maggie had made it to the top and gotten out of the chimney. If they could make it, he told himself, so could he. Below him, the gunfire had stopped, although it was a moment or two before the kid realized it wasn't starting up again. For just a second, he closed his eyes.
Vaya con Dios.
He resumed climbing, forcing himself up the shaft as quickly as he could. Once Tarleton and his hired killers realized that the kid, James, and Maggie were gone, they'd start looking around. It wouldn't take them long to find the chimney leading up from the cave. Unlike the Apaches, they wouldn't be afraid to venture into the final resting place of that old Indian. The little opening above him grew larger, though it still seemed maddeningly far away. The kid gritted his teeth. The killers were in the cave. If they found the escape route, all they'd have to do was stick a couple of revolvers up the chimney and empty them. There was no place in there for him to hide. He couldn't control what they did down there. All he could do was keep climbing. The opening was 50 feet above him, he estimated. Then 40, then 30, then 20. The shaft narrowed even more so that he could barely force himself through it. 10 feet to go. He reached up, caught hold of a small projection, pulled up and shoved with his feet at the same time. 5 feet. A few more seconds and he'd be able to reach up and grab the edge of the opening. Then it would be a simple matter to pull himself out.
Get up there, you fool! Get!
The kid started scrambling the few remaining feet.
Grab my hand!
The kid lunged upward and caught hold of James's wrist. The brawny young man hauled him upward. The kid's booted feet pushed against the sides of the chimney at the same time. Still hanging onto the kid's arm, James toppled backward. The kid rolled away from the opening just as guns began to roar at the other end. The kid jerked out his Colt, and as soon as the shooting stopped below, he thrust it into the opening. He wasn't really trying to hit anything. He just wanted them to think twice before they started climbing up the chimney themselves. He looked around and saw that James and Maggie appeared to be all right, except for a few bloody places where the rock walls had scraped them as they were climbing. Relieved to see that, the kids studied their surroundings. Just as Whitfield had said, they were at the top of the mountain. Big Hatchet Mountain, a half mile or so to the south, was the only one in the range that was taller. The slopes of the peak were tufted with grass and fell away fairly steeply, but the kid saw several places where he and the McTavishes could start making their way down.
Come on.
The kid pushed himself to his feet.
We need to get moving. Tarleton's not going to let us live if he can prevent it. He and his men will be looking for us soon.
We just got out of that hole. We need to rest for a few minutes.
Where's Mr. Whitfield?
He stayed below to give us more time to get away. We can't let what he did go to waste. Come on.
James got to his feet and took his sister's arm.
Let me help you, Maggie.
I'm all right. You're the one who's wounded.
Just scratches. Nothing to worry about.
The kid got them moving down the far side of the slope, away from the benches where the showdown had taken place. He wanted to put as much distance as he could between them and Tarleton's bunch. But sooner or later, he would have to confront them again, he thought as he glanced back. He had left the buckskin on the upper bench, and James and Meggie didn't have horses either. Tarleton and his hired killers had the only mounts, which meant that the kid would have to take some away from them. The three of them made their way down the slope.
How are we going to get away from them? We don't have any horses. Even if we manage to give them the slip, we'll starve to death before we can walk all the way back home.
We're not going to walk all the way back. We'll get our hands on some horses.
How?
Let me worry about that.
Like you've worried about everything else?
You never do change, do you, James? You have to complain about everything.
If I hadn't pulled you out of that hole, those fellas would have ventilated you for sure.
Yes, they would have. And I'm glad you reminded me of that. I forgot to say thank you. I am obliged to you for the help, James.
Forget it.
No, I won't do that. I won't forget what Dave Whitfield did for us either. When we do get back, there's going to be peace between the McTavishes and the Circle D.
That's right, James. There won't be any more feuding.
But, ha!
I said, there won't be any more feuding.
The descent was actually easier on the western side of the mountain range than it would have been on the eastern side. They didn't encounter any cliffs. Some of the slopes were steep enough so that they had to turn around and back down them, clinging to rocks and bushes and clumps of grass to keep their balance, but that was the worst of it. By late morning, they were in the lower canyons. Another stretch of desert rolled off to the west. A range of mountains that looked to be about the same size as the Hatchets lay in that direction, 10 to 20 miles away. The heat was already getting bad as the sun rose higher in the sky. The kid knew he and his companions couldn't walk that far during the day. Heading for those other mountains wouldn't do them any good anyway. Tarleton, Pamela, and the hired killers would spot them easily out there in that vast open area. What he really needed, the kid thought, was somewhere he could leave the McTavishes while he tried to get his hands on some horses. He found just the place a short time later. It was a little canyon with a narrow opening, no more than 30 feet across, and thick brush closed off most of that. The kid just happened to notice it, and he thought it was possible men on horseback might ride on past without giving it a second look.
The two of you stay here. There's some shade in those rocks, so the heat and sun shouldn't be too bad.
There's no water here. No food.
That's true, but by sometime tonight, I'm hoping you'll be on your way back to Val Verde with enough supplies and canteens to get you there safely.
You expect those things to fall down from the sky?
No. I expect to steal them from those varmints who've been trying to kill us.
By the time dusk began to settle again over the Hatchet Mountains, a tired, sunburned, hungry, and footsore Kid Morgan had located his quarry. It made sense that Tarleton and Pamela would order their gunmen to spread out and search for the three fugitives. With less than a dozen men, though, there was only so much ground the killers could cover. Because of that, the kid couldn't just sit back and wait for some of them, and more importantly, their horses, to come to him. He had to find them. So once again, the hunters had become the hunted. The kid crouched behind a rock and watched two men on horseback sit at the mouth of a canyon and debate whether or not they ought to ride up into it and carry on the search.
I don't like it. It's already too dark and shadowy up there. I say we ought to go back to camp and wait there for the others.
What are you worried about? There are just three of them, and they ain't armed.
That's not true. Browning's got a pistol, according to what Miss Tarleton told her uncle.
Some eastern dude playing gunfighter? You afraid he's gonna ambush us, Carlin?
It could happen. A bullet fired by an eastern dude can kill you just as fast.
That was true, the kid thought. He had proven it on numerous occasions. Carlin's companion hitched his horse into motion.
Well, I'm gonna take a look up this canyon. You can stay here if you want, but if I catch those three, then I'll get all the credit.
All right, all right.
Carlin started his horse forward, too.
I'm coming.
The kid knew they wouldn't find anything in the canyon. He waited until they were out of sight, then hurried after them, using every rock and tree and bush for cover. Their mention of the group's camp intrigued him. That would be the best target for a raid. He couldn't follow them back to it on foot, though. He needed to find out its location and get his hands on at least one horse right now. That might be a tall order. The sound of hoofbeats suddenly coming closer made him scramble for cover behind a slab of rock leaning against the canyon wall. The two gunmen hadn't gone very far before running into a dead end, and they were returning. The kid began climbing onto the rock, quickly formulating a plan as he did so. He waited on the side where they couldn't see him until they rode past. As they did that, he launched himself in a diving tackle. The kid crashed into him and drove him out of the saddle. Both men landed heavily on the ground, but the kid was on top and the impact stunned the gunman momentarily. The kid rolled away and came up with his Colt in his hand as the other man fired at him. He triggered his revolver and sent a slug into the killer's chest. The man slewed halfway around in the saddle, tried to hang on, but toppled off his horse anyway. The first man stirred as his wits started to come back to him. The kid reversed the gun in his hand and slammed the butt against the man's head. He'd knocked him out cold. The kid hurried over to check the man he had shot. He knew he didn't have much time. The second man was dead, drilled through the heart. As soon as the kid was sure of that, he swung around and grabbed the horses before they could bolt. The pair of shots would draw the attention of the other searchers, he was sure. He wanted to be well away from there before any of them could show up to see what had happened. He lifted the man he had knocked out, slung him over the saddle on one of the horses, and lashed him into place with the rope that was on the saddle. He tied the man's hands and feet together under the horse's belly. Then he swung up onto the other mount and rode away into the dusk, leading the horse with its unconscious burden. He had two horses, but that wasn't enough. If he went straight back to the canyon where he'd left James and Maggie, someone would have to ride double, which would slow them down enough that the pursuit was bound to catch them. The kid had an idea what to do about that, but it would take some more work on his part. Gun work, more than likely. He put some distance between himself and the site of the brief gunfight, heading south now, around Big Hatchet Mountain. As the shadows thickened, he listened intently because the sound of hoofbeats might well be the only warning he got if he was about to run into more of Tarleton's men. When he'd gone about a mile, he reined in. The man on the other horse struggled against the rope that held him on the saddle. The kid dismounted, stepped over to the other horse, and pressed the muzzle of his Colt against the man's head.
Browning?
Never mind who I am. Tell me where the camp is.
Get me off this horse first. My head hanging upside down like this is making me...
The kid stepped back to avoid being splattered. He didn't worry about a trick. Throwing up was something a fella couldn't really fake.
Oh, son of a bitch. Come on, Browning. Give me a break here.
Like you gave a break to those men at Whitfield's you massacred?
They were hired guns, too. Hell, they knew what they were getting into.
The man was right about that. It didn't make him any less of a cold-blooded killer. The kid pointed the Colt at him again.
Talk.
You want to know where the camp is? Fine, I'll tell you. You gotta let me loose first. You give me my horse back so I can get out of here. After Hogan and the others kill you, I just assume they think I'm dead, so they won't come after me for double-crossing them.
You're not going to double-cross me. You're taking me to the camp.
You go to hell.
The kid thrust the gun barrel against the man's temple again.
I've already reduced the odds against me by one. Knocking them down one more can't hurt anything.
Whoa, wait. Hold on. Don't shoot, mister. We can work something out.
Damn right we can. Where's the camp?
You remember the place you left the girl? Miss Tarleton? That's where her uncle said we'd all rendezvous.
That made sense. There was water there, and it was at the base of Big Hatchet Mountain, which meant it was about in the center of the range on the eastern side. Straight across the mountain from where he was right now, the kid thought. He wondered if there was a trail that would let them reach the place without having to go all the way around. That would certainly make things simpler, assuming, of course, that his prisoner was telling the truth.
You're still coming with me.
The kid stepped back and holstered his gun.
That way, if you're lying, you'll regret it.
Oh, mister, I already regret ever signing on with this bunch. I'm sick, I tell you. At least untie me so I could sit up in the saddle.
Sorry.
Gagging the prisoner was an obvious precaution. The kid had ripped pieces off the gunman's shirt to serve as a gag and tied it in place. Then he set off up the slopes in the dark, hoping to find a pass to the other side. The kid had discovered that he had a natural sense of direction, something else he had inherited from Frank Morgan. Even though natural obstacles forced him to take a twisting path through the mountains, he always had a general idea which direction he was going and which way he needed to go. After several hours, he'd managed to reach the eastern side of the Hatchet Range. The prisoner, who had tried to yell and curse through the gag at first, just like Pamela, had fallen silent after a while. When the kid figured he was within half a mile of the camp, if the captive gunman was telling the truth, he reined in, dismounted, and cut the man loose, letting him fall to the ground. The kid hunkered next to the prisoner and used the pieces of rope to tie his hands and feet.
You're staying right here.
He straightened to his feet.
If you weren't lying to me, I'll come back to turn you loose later. If I get killed, well, you better hope no wolves or anything like that come along, I guess.
The kid turned away. He had left the ropes loose enough so that the man could work his way free eventually, although it might take him hours to do so. The hombre would figure that out sooner or later when the kid didn't come back for him. Leading the horses, the kid worked his way closer to the little pool at the edge of the foothills. He caught the scent of wood smoke and knew he was smelling a campfire. So the man he'd captured hadn't lied to him after all. Tarleton, Pamela, and the others really were camped here. If what Jess Winger had told him earlier in the day was true, there were only 11 of them left, counting Tarleton and Trace. Still bad odds, but getting better all the time, the kid told himself with a grim smile. He left the horses tied to a mesquite tree and approached the camp as carefully and quietly as he could. Through a screen of brush, he caught sight of the flickering flames of the campfire. The kid bellied down and went the rest of the way in a crawl. When he got close enough to part the brush and peer through the tiny gap, he saw that no one was talking around the campfire. It was late enough so that at least some of the group would be asleep. One man was sitting up by the fire, standing guard while everyone else was rolled up in blankets. The lone sentry had his back to the flames so that they wouldn't ruin his night vision. On the other side of the pool, the horses were gathered in a makeshift corral formed by stringing ropes between some of the pines. The kid had his eye on them, but he waited patiently until he was sure that each of the bedrolls actually contained a sleeping body. He didn't move until he saw each of them shift around a little in slumber to be certain there was only one guard. Tarleton must have felt confident that they were in no danger. If he'd been in charge, the kid thought, he would have posted at least a couple of men out from the camp a little way. Once he was satisfied, he crawled around the pool toward the horses. His heart gave a little leap when he spotted the buckskin among them. The saddlebags from the other horses were piled up just outside the corral. The kid figured those saddlebags had some supplies in them, so he planned to grab as many as he could before he left there. The horses stirred a little as he slipped into the makeshift corral. The guard glanced toward them, but the kid was stooped low enough that the man couldn't see him. The horses shielded him from view. He waited until the guard turned around again before he used his knife to cut the rope between two of the pines. Then he grabbed the buckskin's reins and vaulted into the saddle. He yanked his hat off and slapped it against the rumps of several horses. The panicky animals stampeded straight ahead. Their route took them right through the sleeping gunman. The kid had noticed two bedrolls off to the side and figured they belonged to Tarleton and Pamela. The horses missed those as they bolted, but the kid didn't take the time to see if his guess was right. Instead, he leaned down, scooped up as many of the saddlebags as he could, slung them over the buckskin's back, and sent the horse lunging ahead in the wake of the others, drawing his Colt as he did so. Even though they had been startled out of a sound sleep, Tarleton's men were professionals. They came out of their blankets alert with guns in their hands. The kid swept his Colt in an arc toward them. Two of the men tumbled backward, driven off their feet by the kid's slugs smashing into them. Another doubled over, clutching his belly as he staggered to the side. Yet another man was down as well, probably trampled by the stampeding horses. Then the kid was through the camp, flashing past the remaining gunmen. He bent low over the neck of the galloping buckskin as the men still on their feet opened fire. Hot lead clawed through the night, searching for him. None of it found him. The buckskin didn't break stride, so the kid was confident that his horse hadn't been hit. The rest of the horses were still in front of him. They veered toward the desert, and he let them go, firing his gun over their backs to speed them on their way. Chances were they would keep running for miles before they stopped. It would take Tarleton's men most of the day to round them up, if they were even able to find all the horses. In one bold stroke, the kid had crippled his enemies. The fight wasn't over yet, and he had to get James and Maggie McTavish started on their way to safety. He had picked up the two saddled horses he had left tied up, then used the same pass he had found earlier and made his way back over Big Hatchet Mountain. The stars told him it was long after midnight before he approached the canyon where he had left James and Maggie. He hoped he was in the right place. The night was so dark he couldn't be sure. The McTavishes were probably sleeping the sleep of exhaustion by then.
James! Maggie! Can you hear me?
Browning! Over here!
The kid followed his voice and a minute later came up to the brush-choked opening of the canyon. James and Maggie hurried out.
Mr. Browning, are you all right? We thought we heard some shooting a few hours ago, but it was a long way off.
That was me, but I'm fine. I have horses and supplies for you now. You can start back to Valverde.
Don't we need to wait until morning?
It'll be light in another couple of hours, but I don't see any reason to wait that long. I've started to learn my way around these mountains. I think you should head due north. That'll take you back to the Southern Pacific Line, and when you hit it, you can follow it all the way to Valverde.
What about Tarleton and those hired guns?
I scattered their horses pretty good. I think it'll be halfway back to town before they could start after you, even if they wanted to, which they won't.
You're not coming with us, are you?
Like I said, I'll point you in the right direction. Both of those horses have rifles in the saddle boot, so you'll have guns and food. There's some water in those canteens, but if you come to a creek or a spring, it'd be a good idea to fill them up. You'll make it through just fine.
And what are you going to do?
I'm not finished here yet.
By the time dawn grayed the eastern sky, the kid had taken James and Maggie to the northern tip of the Hatchet Range, pointed them in the right direction, and said farewell to them. Maggie hugged him, and James shook hands.
Thanks for everything you've done, Browning. You never gave up on getting us away from those varmints. I just wish... Well, shoot, I can't believe I'm saying this. I wish old Devil Dave had made it out, too.
So do I. Keep your eyes open, find the railroad, head east. You'll be all right.
I reckon we will be.
The kid watched them ride off, then turned and headed south again, riding along the eastern slope of the mountains with the rugged peaks to his right. He was alone again, and that was the way he liked it. No more innocence would get hurt as he finished what he'd set out to do. The sun peeked over the horizon a short time later, spilling orange and gold light over the land. The kid kept an eye on the desert, thinking that he might spot some of Tarleton's men searching for their horses. It wasn't long before he noticed a couple of dark specks out there that quickly resolved themselves into the figures of two men trudging along. He circled around so that he could come at them out of the sun, then trotted the buckskin toward them. They must have taken him for one of their group because they stopped and just stood there as he approached, shading their eyes in an effort to make him out against the glare of the rising sun. He was within 30 yards of them before they realized their mistake. They both slapped leather. Neither of those return shots came anywhere close to the kid. Both of the men were already dead before they hit the ground. He rode on, leaving the two dead gun wolves where they had fallen. His destination was the little oasis where the killers had made their camp the night before. He suspected that he'd find Tarleton and Pamela there, since he couldn't see either of them walking through the desert looking for the scattered horses. They would rely on the men they were paying to bring their mounts back to them. With his injured leg, Hogan wouldn't be tramping around the desert either, which meant only two men were left out there, plus Trace. Slowly but surely, he was taking care of them. If he could live a while longer, soon the only ones left would be the two people most responsible for what happened to Rebel. He would take them back and turn them over to the law, he told himself. He wasn't a cold-blooded murderer, despite what had happened in the past. Dust spiraling up into the air off to his left caught his eye. He turned and saw two men on horseback galloping toward him. A couple of the hired guns had caught their horses faster than he'd expected them to. That guess was confirmed a second later when powder smoke spurted from the riders' guns and bullets began kicking up dust not far away. The kid took out the Winchester and took aim. The first gunman flung his arms out to the sides as the bullet drove deep in his chest. He turned a backward somersault off the horse. Before the kid shifted his aim, a bullet grazed his side. The kid quickly brought up his rifle. The bullet ripped into the man's skull. He folded up and toppled out of the saddle. The horse kept going, passing the kid by. He slid a couple of rounds into the Winchester's loading gate and checked the first man he'd shot. The hired gun was dead. Not so much, however, that the kid couldn't tell who he was, or rather, who he wasn't. So far, the kid hadn't seen any sign of Jack Trace among the men he'd encountered. He really wanted to catch up to the little gunslinger. If Trace hadn't betrayed Dave Whitfield, things might not have played out as they did. The rancher might even still be alive, if not for Trace's treachery. Trace was either still out there on the desert somewhere or back at the camp with Tarleton and Pamela. The kid headed toward the foothills. He had chopped the odds down far enough to go ahead and confront the two masterminds behind all the hell he had gone through. He had entered the hills a good distance north of the campsite he had raided the night before. He rode into the mountains and began working his way around so that he could come at the camp from above. When he was close, he dismounted and went the rest of the way on foot, pausing on a little ridge that overlooked the pool surrounded by pine trees and grass. A man sat in the shade of the trees, and after a moment the kid was able to see him well enough to recognize the gunman called Hogan. The man's right leg stuck out straight in front of him. Someone had tied a couple of branches onto it to serve as crude splints. Hogan's head leaned back against the trunk. It looked like he was asleep. That wasn't the case, though, because after a moment, Hogan's left hand came into view as he lifted a bottle of whiskey to his mouth. He took a long swig, then lowered the bottle to his side again. The kid didn't see any sign of Tarleton or Pamela. A frown creased his forehead as he studied the camp. He'd been convinced that the two of them would be there. The idea of them tramping around the desert looking for the runaway horses just didn't ring true for him. They were the sort of people who relied on others to do any physical labor for them. After a few minutes, the kid accepted the evidence of his own eyes. Hogan was alone. Carefully, the kid moved closer. He drew his gun and leveled it at Hogan as he stepped out of the brush. The gunman didn't seem surprised to see him.
I was wondering when you'd get here, Browning.
Where are the others?
Gone. You don't see them anywhere around here, do you?
They just left you here?
Well, I can't very well walk. Not with this leg you busted for me.
So they abandoned you? I thought they'd wait here until the others rounded up the horses and brought them back.
What others? They're all dead, except for Pamela and Tarleton and Trace. I reckon you killed the ones who went looking for the horses, since you're here. And still alive.
Wait a minute. The numbers don't add up. There should be at least one more man out there somewhere.
No. The other fella, name of Horrigan, if that matters, died early this morning from being busted up when you stampeded those horses through the camp. You killed two men, and Loomis got run over and had his head stove in then and there. You pretty near wiped us out, Browning. Any normal man would have given up when he saw the odds against him. But you just kept on coming till nearly everybody was dead.
The kid nodded, willing to accept what Hogan told him. The man was too drunk to be lying, he decided.
So Pamela and Tarleton decided to go with Trace and hunt for the horses.
Yeah. She said she loved me. But once she saw I was crippled, it didn't take her any time at all to realize she'd been wrong about that. She started playing up to Trace instead.
That doesn't surprise me.
The kid moved so that he could look around the tree where Hogan was sitting.
They didn't even leave you a gun?
Nope. Just this bottle. A hell of a note, ain't it?
Once I get back to civilization, I'll send somebody out here to find you.
Hell with that! I'll be dead by then, and you know it. Kill me, Browning.
He tapped his forehead.
One shot. Right here. Get it over with, damn you. Finish what you started.
The kid had lowered his gun.
I can't do that.
Why not? Too merciful for you, you son of a bitch.
That leg of yours will heal. You might not ever walk right again, but it won't kill you. You won't die of thirst either with that pool right there. I'll leave enough supplies to hold you for a few days. You'll get hungry, but you won't starve to death.
Forget it. You know how much my life will be worth once word gets around that I'm a cripple? I got enemies. They'll come for me.
Sorry.
Oh, goddamn.
The kid pouched his iron and started to back away. Hogan sat up again, twisted around, and grabbed hold of the tree. He used it as support and struggled to pull himself to his feet.
Damn it, Browning! Kill me!
The kid turned and walked away. Hogan started after him, stumping along on his one good leg and the splinted injured one. After making it only a couple of steps, he stumbled and fell.
Damn you, Browning! Damn you!
Too late.
The kid mounted his horse and rode out into the desert. He wasn't sure if Hogan would make it. Maybe he wouldn't. It was out of the kid's hands now. Quite a few tracks led away from the campsite, but there was only one set of three. Those footprints had belonged to Pamela, Tarleton, and Trace. The kid followed them, knowing that it wouldn't take him long to catch up since he was on horseback and they were afoot. Half an hour later, he saw something lying on the ground up ahead. As he kicked the buckskin into a fast trot, he realized the shape was that of a man lying face down. The hombre was too big to be Jack Trace, and as the kid came closer, he recognized the dark suit that Anthony Tarleton had been wearing. Tarleton didn't move as the kid approached. He had to be either dead or unconscious. Otherwise, he would have heard the hoofbeats. The kid reined to a halt about 20 feet away and drew his gun. He didn't think Tarleton was trying some sort of trick, but he couldn't rule out the possibility. The kid dismounted and moved closer on foot. Tarleton still didn't move. The kid hooked a toe under the man's shoulder and rolled him onto his back. A large, dark bloodstain spread over the front of Tarleton's shirt. It looked like he'd been shot at least twice. At first, the kid thought he was dead, but then he saw Tarleton's chest moving. The man's eyelids fluttered as the bright sunlight struck them. The kid moved so that his shadow fell over Tarleton's face. Tarleton's eyes opened and peered up at him, but the kid wasn't sure Tarleton really saw anything. He seemed more dead than alive. The kid hunkered on his heels.
Tarleton? Can you hear me?
Browning? Is that?
Yes, it's me. What happened to you?
Pamela. She did this.
Pamela shot you? Your own niece?
There were only two horses.
Ah.
Browning, everything that happened to your wife, it was Pamela's idea. You have to help me.
There's nothing I can do for you. You're dying, Tarleton. I'm surprised you're not dead already.
Then you've got to settle the score with that bitch. They're headed for Valverde. Don't let her get away with...
I don't plan to let her get away with anything.
Tarleton didn't hear what the kid said. His eyes were already glazed over. His plea for vengeance on his niece had been his dying words. The kid straightened. He had told the truth. He didn't intend to let Pamela get away with everything she had done. He wouldn't be settling any scores for Anthony Tarleton, though. The man had brought his own doom upon him by allying himself with Pamela. He took the buckskin's reins in his hand. He pointed the horse's head northeast, following the trail left by Pamela and Trace. Just the two of them left for him to deal with. They were an hour, maybe an hour and a half ahead of him. But he was in no hurry to catch up. The showdown, when it came, would be in Valverde, the same place Rebel was laid to rest. The excited shouts made the kid look over toward the hotel. He saw Rory McTavish standing there waving at him and turned the buckskin in that direction. The kid reined to a stop in front of the hotel porch.
Howdy, Rory.
I thought that was you, but you look different.
Never mind that. How's your father? Did he pull through?
Yeah. Doc Churchill said it was touch and go for a while there, but now he thinks Pa's gonna be all right.
The kid felt relief wash through him at that news. He was glad Hamish McTavish hadn't died because of Pamela's twisted need for vengeance.
What about your brother and sister? Are they here?
They rode in this morning. I was never so glad to see anybody in my life. Whew, I was afraid they wouldn't make it back. They said they wouldn't have if it hadn't been for you, Mr. Browning.
Just call me Kid. Conrad Browning's not really here anymore.
All right. Oh, well, James and Miggy aren't the only ones who rode in today. That gunfighter who worked for Mr. Whitfield, Jack Trace, he's in town too. I saw him go into the saloon a little while ago.
What about Miss Tarleton?
Haven't seen her.
That surprised the kid. He wondered where Pamela was. But there was still Trace to deal with. He swung down from the saddle and held out the reins to Rory.
You mind taking my horse over to the livery stable? Tell them to take mighty good care of him. He's been through a lot the past few days.
Eagerly, Rory took the reins.
Yes, sir. Sure I can do that. Well, what are you going to do, Mr. Browning? Go in the hotel and clean up?
Not just yet.
The kid turned and walked toward the saloon.
Holy cow. Well, I gotta get back so I can see this.
The kid had taken it easy during the day and a half ride back to Valverde, not moving any faster than his quarry. Despite that, a great weariness gripped him. The grief and strain of the past few months was like an unbearable weight on his shoulders, threatening to press him down until there was nothing left of him. There was only one way to lift that weight. His side was stiff and sore where the bullet had creased him. His shirt stuck to the dried blood. His legs and back ached from the long hours in the saddle, but none of that mattered. He felt an irresistible force drawing him on toward the bat-winged entrance of the saloon. A hard desert wind sprang up, lifting the dust in the street. He stepped onto the low porch, pushed the bat wings aside, and proceeded into the cool dimness of the place. The drinkers at the bar and the card players at the tables began to scatter. How they knew what was coming, the kid didn't know or care. They were like wild animals, fleeing instinctively before a natural disaster. That left a lone, slender figure standing at the far end of the bar, his left hand raised halfway to his mouth with a shot glass of whiskey in it.
I knew you'd make it out alive.
Time to see who's faster, Trace.
About time.
Trace dropped the empty glass at the same instant he spun toward the kid, his hand flashing toward his gun. The kid felt the hammer blow of a bullet striking him. He took a step back but caught himself before he fell. Down the bar, Jack Trace stood there smiling, smoke curling from the barrel of the gun he held.
Like something out of a dime novel, ain't it?
Then blood slid from the corner of his mouth, and his fingers lost their grip on the gun. Trace made a half turn and fell against the bar, then toppled away from it to land on his back, his arms outflung. A shudder went through his body, and then he lay still. The kid felt a hot weakness filling him. He lowered his gun and turned to stumble back out into the sunlight. With the wind in his face, he reeled across the boardwalk, caught hold of one of the posts supporting the awning. As he leaned against it, he looked down at himself and saw the fresh bloodstain on his left side. He knew Trace's slug must have broken a rib at the very least. He gritted his teeth, but not from the pain. He hadn't found out from Trace where Pamela was, and now the gunman was dead. He would have to try to backtrack them. The kid lifted his head. That movement took his eyes along the street toward the mission. He blinked against the dust and the glare of the sun on the whitewashed adobe walls as he saw movement in the cemetery. A woman, her long skirt swishing around her legs as she walked, a shawl over her head, protecting her from the sun. Was he imagining things? Had the pain from his wound and the blood he'd lost sent him over the edge into madness? No, she was really there. As she began to walk faster toward the depot, the shawl slipped back to reveal thick brown hair falling around her shoulders. Pamela. She was going to catch that train and ride away, out of his life, safe once again from the justice she so richly deserved. That thought stiffened his spine. He stepped down to the street and staggered forward. The train station was between them. The kid was a little closer to it, but all he could do was shamble along. Pamela saw him and stopped short for a second, then hurried toward the depot. The kid forced himself to move faster. He saw puffs of white smoke and steam rising from the engine as it rolled over the tracks just west of the settlement. Agony stabbed through the kid with every step, but he didn't slow down. He broke into an awkward run. He didn't go into the station itself, but headed for the stairs at the end of the platform instead. He recognized Maggie McTavish's voice, and he glanced over to see her, James, and Rory running toward the station from the hotel. He waved them back. Pamela was bound to have a gun, and she wouldn't hesitate to use it on anyone who got in her way. He reached the steps and stumbled up them. The few people who were waiting to board the train or to meet someone getting off gasped in surprise at the bloody figure who was suddenly among them. At the sight of the gun in his hand, they backed off. Some of them turned and ran into the depot. Pamela came up the steps at the far end of the platform and stopped as she saw him again.
Why won't you just die, you son of a bitch? Why won't you just die?
Not until you get what's coming to you.
The kid started along the platform toward her.
Oh, I had to stop at the cemetery to tell your precious rebel that you were dead. I hate anyone making a liar out of me, Conrad. Just like I hate anyone who takes me for a fool.
Her hand came up, and sure enough, there was a pistol in it. The kid knew he should lift his coat and fire, but he couldn't do it. Even after all she had done, he couldn't bring himself to slam a bullet into her. But he weaved to the side as she fired. He lunged forward, jerking backwards as her gun fired again. She stood there like an angel of death, tall and haughty, the long shawl slipping off one shoulder to flap in the wind, an angel's wing. No, not an angel. Heaven had no place for the pure evil that was Pamela Tarleton. He reached for her and knocked the gun aside. She slashed the barrel across his face and twisted away from him.
Damn you! Damn you! Conrad Browning!
Pamela was about to bring up the gun again as the locomotive roared right past behind her. The kid never knew what Pamela's trailing shawl caught on. All he knew was that one second he was looking into her hate-filled face. And the next, the shawl jerked tight around her neck and pulled her off the platform under the wheels of the train. Her cry was lost in the hiss of escaping steam as the locomotive slowed.
Ah! Oh my God!
The kid turned and the world spun crazily around him. He would have fallen, but James and Rory were there to catch him.
Come on, Mr. Browning. Come on. There's nothing you can do here.
Rory was right. There was nothing more he could do. It was over at last. Justice had been done. Justice of a sort, anyway. In this world, the kid supposed, that was the most anybody could hope for. A week later, the kid stopped by the mission to say goodbye to Father Francisco, who was almost recovered from his wound. The kid was feeling better, too, although Dr. Churchill had warned him it was too soon for him to be riding. The advice was probably good, but the kid ignored it. He was ready to put Valverde behind him. For now. As long as Rebel was there, he would be back from time to time. There would be fresh flowers on her grave every month. He had already made those arrangements, including a sizable donation to the mission, with Father Francisco. Conrad Browning's money was good for something. Hamish McTavish and his children were back home, where Hamish continued to recuperate. The kid had told Angeline Whitfield of her father's wish that the feud with the McTavishes come to an end, and she had surprised him a little by agreeing. Grief had matured her, given her strength. It was a shame that it sometimes took a tragedy to make a person grow up, but the kid knew that was true. Angeline planned to stay on and run the Circle D. Some of the ranch hands had taken wagons down to the hatchets and recovered all the bodies, including Devil Dave's. After her father's funeral, Angeline had hinted to the kid that she wouldn't mind if he stayed around too. But he just wished her luck. That was all he could do. He tied the buckskin to the hitching post in front of the mission. He had sold the buggy and the big black horse. They were left over from Conrad Browning's life, and he didn't need them anymore. Father Francisco came out of the mission and greeted him.
Hello, my friend. You look like you're ready to travel.
Ready as I'll ever be.
Where are you going?
That's a good question, Padre.
Well, you're still a young man. You have time to find whatever it is you are looking for.
I hope you're right, Father.
The kid started walking along the path toward the cemetery. The priest fell in beside him.
I couldn't leave without stopping by here one more time.
They brought the new stone this morning, you know.
I know.
They both stopped at the cemetery gate.
I'll let you go alone. God's blessings upon you, my son.
Thanks, Father.
Hat in hand, the kid walked into the cemetery and stopped in front of Rebel's grave. He hadn't replaced the tombstone that her brothers had put up, but he'd had another stone made for the foot of the grave. It was flat and lay almost flush with the ground. The words engraved on it were simple. Rebel, one love for all time. A few minutes later, Kid Morgan left the cemetery. He rode out of Valverde, a lone rider headed north. No reason, just moving on.
The Loner, Book 2, The Devil's Badland, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2009, J.A. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Eric Messner, Elizabeth Jernigan, Kimberly Gilbert, Dan Stevens, Michael Glenn, Ren Casey, Yasmin Toison, Stephen Carpenter, Thomas Keegan, Joe Brack, Johann Detweiler, Ken Jackson, Mort Shelby, Thomas Penny, Tim Carlin, Richard Rowan, Christopher Graybill, and Joseph Thornhill. Additional red shirts by the Dead Giveaways. Directed by Nathaniel Perry. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers, James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing, graphic audio sound design, and book adaptation by Nathaniel Perry. The Loner theme was composed by Nathaniel Perry, with additional original music by Nathaniel Perry and Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed The Loner, be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's The Last Gunfighter, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our action-pumped titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
What's up?
I've got a case. I need you, Danny.
She pushed the file toward me. There were homicide Lay's photos. Gods above, when was this?
4 months ago. Look past the body.
My eyes moved over the picture. A pile of something wrinkled laid off to one side. Is that what I think? Oh, don't tell me it is.
The fucker flayed her.
I don't want to remember Rigger Hall. I have done very well for years without remembering.
Welcome to the House of Pain.
Have a nice night.
It is extremely unlikely.
Rigger Hall. I swore I'd never go back.
Dante Valentine, Book 2, Dead Man Rising, Part 1, is available now in graphic audio.
Remember Rigger Hall.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.